Ladies and gentlemen, good day and welcome to the Investec Capital Services Private Limited conference call, and the topic is COVID and its impact on global growth. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode, and there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions after the presentation concludes. Should you need assistance during the conference call, please signal an operator by pressing star then zero on your touch-tone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I now hand the conference over to Mr. Mukul Kochar. Thank you, and over to you, sir.
Thanks. Hi, good afternoon, everyone. Investec's global economics team is here with us today to discuss an update of their global GDP growth projection. In an ever-evolving backdrop, as roughly 25-30% of the global population comes under lockdown. The economic costs of the lockdown are going to be quite severe, with U.S. GDP growth itself set to decline from 10-20% in the upcoming quarter. A global recession seems inevitable at this point. There is, however, substantial coordinated action being undertaken across the world mitigating the impact, with the latest stimulus package in the U.S. aggregating $2 trillion, or roughly 10% of GDP. The shape the crisis evolves is firmly in the hand of the governments right now, as not only the health outcome, but the economic recovery will depend upon the determination shown by the governments in the face of this adversity. Our team has analyzed all actions and early data coming in from China, US, and Europe, and crystallized our thoughts into a note which you may have received. The note was published last evening. With this, I will invite Ryan from the economics team to discuss broad takeaways, and then we will open up for questions. Ryan, please go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Mukul. Good afternoon, everyone. I think as we all realize, this is very much unprecedented times globally with the outbreak of COVID-19. As I'm sure many of you are aware, the total number of confirmed infections continues to rise. It's roughly rising by about 100,000 cases globally every 3 days, but basically we're on 500,000 at present. As Mukul said, we're kind of looking at around a quarter of the world's population facing some kind of restriction in terms of population movement. Now, I suppose the key question for the macro backdrop is, what does this mean for global growth? Essentially, and very simply, a very bleak outlook for 2020. We are now actually forecasting global growth this year of a contraction of 0.5%. That would be a touch weaker than what we saw in 2009, which is down 0.3%. That's a material change from our forecast of 2.8%, which we published literally a month ago. I suppose, just to note, I suppose the speed of this, there's 2 points behind that significant change over the course of 1 month. Firstly, the speed and the spread of the virus across the world has been a lot quicker than we and I think many others would have thought, particularly the spread to Western Europe, which is currently being classified as the epicenter of the current outbreak, obviously taking that mantle from China. But obviously, given developments in the US where you've got cases verging on 70,000 now, there are serious concerns about the spread in the United States as well. Second to that, the containment measures that have been announced globally. If you took us back a month ago, I think few people would have thought that the draconian measures that had been applied in China could be replicated in, I suppose, the liberal Western democracies. But obviously, several weeks down the line, and that is certainly the case. And one point that we would argue is that when you're looking at the COVID-9 outbreak, and in particular its impact on economic activities, it is the containment measures which really start to hit household spending and business activity, given that people are literally confined to their houses. So we would argue, as I said, that it's the containment measures as much as anything else that is very much detrimental to economic activity. In terms of individual economies, I have to say it's hard to estimate the impact of the total sudden stop in economic activities. which is very much centered on the service sector, which for most, I suppose, advanced economies is very much the dominant sector. For example, in the UK, the service sector makes up something like 70% of GDP. But in very broad terms, we see a sharp shock being, of which being greater than that of the 08-09 financial crisis in several of the major economies. To highlight some numbers, in the US, we're looking at an 8% contraction over two quarters. The bulk of that coming in Q2, where we see a 6.5% quarter-on-quarter fall in GDP. I suppose it's just one point to note on the US numbers. You may see that certainly some other banks, competitors, publishing US falls or US contractions of something in the range of 10 to 20% in Q2. The point just to note on that is that US numbers tend to be annualized figures. So that those kind of numbers are the annualized figures for Q2. So if you actually look at it on a comparable basis to our own figures, i.e. a quarter-on-quarter growth rate, they're looking at very similar, I suppose, estimates of around a 5% contraction quarter-on-quarter. For the US, that leaves growth in 2020 at down 3.9%. In the UK, similarly, we're looking at a similar fall in GDP peak to trough of around 8.4%. That presents growth for the year 2020 as a whole at minus 4.4%. And the Eurozone, we're looking at a slightly deeper contraction of 9% over two quarters. 2020 growth forecast as a whole standing at minus 5.6%. But it is worth noting within the Eurozone, that figure varies across countries, and certainly the likes of Italy, the likes of Spain, are set to be more impacted than some of the other economies. One caveat I put on our latest set of forecasts is that these numbers are based very much on the assumption that the virus impact is limited in time, i.e. that it is a short shock, and it's effectively limited to H1 2020, and that through the summer and into the second half of 2020, you start to see a rebound in economic activity as containment measures are lifted. But as I say, these numbers, the backdrop is still highly uncertain. The evolution of the virus itself and its spread is a very much uncertain development. That could lead to our forecast changing again in the future, or even in the near future, should it become apparent that the virus continues to spread at pace, and that containment measures are likely to have to remain in place for a longer period of time. In response to this, you have had significant monetary and fiscal stimulus from the authorities, really taking extraordinary steps to try and soften the economic shock. I think I'd make two key points, I suppose, on the steps being taken. Firstly, I think there is a concerted effort to ensure that this crisis doesn't morph into something which is more pernicious. On the central bank's front, if you look at kind of the composition of the measures that have been announced, I suppose there's twofold things that they're trying to ensure, i.e., that there's sufficient liquidity in the markets, trying to ensure that there is some kind of smooth functioning in financial markets as well, particularly in addressing certain market strains. And if you look at some of the Fed measures over the last couple of weeks, they've been addressed at looking at US funding conditions. Particularly, they launched a commercial paper facility, and that had been in response to a sharp rise in commercial paper yields in the US. And additionally to that, what you've also seen, not just in the US but globally, is some support which is focusing on the corporate sector. As I said, you've got these corporate commercial paper facilities that have been announced by the Fed, the Bank of England, and indeed the ECB is now buying corporate commercial paper as well. And certainly they are addressed at ensuring short-term financing requirements for corporates, But additionally, the Fed took the unprecedented step earlier this week by announcing unlimited QE. The unprecedented point in that as well is that they will also buy corporate bonds for the first time, and that is something that they didn't do even during 2008 and 09. From a government point of view, I think very much the focus is preventing what we would call second round effects. What do I mean here? Essentially, we know this shock is going to be a big hit on household spending and on business activity. If you look at what is being announced around the world, at least from the major economies, it's various measures to try and prevent effectively a collapse in small and medium-sized businesses as a result of a fall in household spending and a resultant surge in unemployment, which would effectively compound the situation and could lead to the shock in economic activity being more long-lasting. I would say if we hadn't had these policy measures in what has been an aggressive and timely move, certainly you could argue that the hit to economic activity could be much worse than even the numbers which we've already penciled in or outlined a minute ago. If I was just to summarise some of those policy measures, at least from the central bank point of view, the Fed has effectively announced unlimited asset purchases. As I said, they've also ventured into the realms of corporate bonds for the first time. Interest rates in the US have been cut to the record lows seen in the financial crisis, i.e. a targeted federal funds range of 0 to 0.25%. They've also enacted various other crisis era tools as well. The commercial paper facility being one, but you've also got the reactivation of TALF and several other facilities as well. In the UK, we've had bank rate cut to a historic low of 10 basis points. QE has been expanded by a further £200 billion. We have something called a term funding scheme, which allows banks to borrow money from the Bank of England for a four-year term on preferential rates, and indeed here we have a commercial paper facility as well. From the Eurozone, QE has been expanded. The ECB was already buying 20 billion euros worth of bonds a month. That's been expanded in two different intervals, 120 billion initially, but that was raised by another 750 billion euros as well. So the ECB, on top of the 20 billion euros of bonds they were already buying a month, the ECB will buy 870 billion euros of bonds during 2020. Now, there's no specific timeline over when those purchases will happen, but they will be done practically on a as-needed basis in order to, I suppose, from one perspective, ensuring some kind of stability and stabilise moves, particularly in fixed income markets, where we have seen a surge, particularly in Italian bond yields over recent weeks. The ECB's also got a TLTRO facility, which provides liquidity to banks for a three-year term. On fiscal policy, I suppose there's a couple of key points here. Obviously, many of us have seen the announcements from the United States overnight. Essentially, the Senate has passed a $2.2 trillion stimulus package to support the economy. That still has to pass the House of Representatives. A vote on that is expected tomorrow, but given that the deal was done at a bipartisan level, we suspect that will go through. And that will be signed by President Trump as soon as that's done. So that should go into force. The $2.2 trillion is probably just worth noting, I suppose, some of the biggest headline-grabbing policy announcements within that is that the US will issue one-time checks to all individuals earning less than $75,000. They will receive checks of $1,200. They will get additional checks of $500 for children. Arguably, this could be classed as what many in the past have termed helicopter money, i.e. directly putting cash in the pockets of individual citizens. In addition to that, there's vast increases in healthcare-related spending. There is also a large sum of loan guarantees, both to large corporates and indeed small corporates. Certainly, that US package is exceptionally large, particularly if you compare it to historical standards. If you take your mind back to the financial crisis in 08-09, the package of measures, stimulatory package of measures, which was put together then, was about $800 billion. So this is more than, far more than double what was done then. In the UK, essentially we've had several rounds of fiscal policy responses, and that is unlikely to be the last of it. Indeed, we're set to get a further announcement from the Chancellor later on today. What's been done in the UK, we've allocated another £5 billion of spending to the NHS. The government has also offered relief for small businesses in terms of the business rate that they have to pay. I suppose importantly, or a major policy announcement last Friday, was a jobs retention scheme. What is that? Well, effectively, for any employees that are furloughed, i.e. put on unpaid leave as a result of the current crisis, the government will cover their salary, their monthly salary, up to a maximum of £2,500. In addition to that, you also have a loan guarantee scheme as well. If I suppose not to go through every individual policy measure globally in terms of the fiscal response, I would say that there's been two responses, or two, I suppose, key policy paths in the government's response to the crisis. For one, as you would expect, there is direct money to the health services, i.e. hospitals and the like, some relief on the tax front. Certainly, there is a widespread policy to some extent of helping employers with employee costs, i.e. policies such as the UK's jobs retention scheme. But also notable is the large amount of loan guarantee schemes that are being put into place. For example, the UK's loan guarantee scheme. So that is effectively £330 billion. The US scheme, if you add it all up, is almost $900 billion. In the Eurozone, you've got similar policy measures such as those from France, where they've got a €300 billion loan guarantee scheme. Italy is also introducing similar measures as well. So, as I said, I suppose a few minutes earlier, very much the response from governments is trying to alleviate some of those strains, particularly on the small and medium-sized business side of things, and then try and essentially keep them afloat during what is assumed to be a short-term shock in the economy. But as I said earlier, how long this may go on for is very much an unknown, and is dependent on the extent of the spread of the virus. But we suspect at present that it should only last for two quarters, and you start to see a rebound in the economy going into 2020. Looking forward, providing that this is a short-term shock, we do expect a rebound in the major economies and in the global growth backdrop. Our forecast for global growth next year is 3.9%. That's an upgrade from our previous forecast of 3.4%. We see US growth at 2.5%, UK growth at 3.3%, and Eurozone growth at 3.5%. In terms of the policy outlook going forward, despite a rebound in growth, our expected rebound in growth in 2021, we suspect that policymakers are likely to err on the side of caution until they are sufficiently confident that economic growth is returning to kind of trend growth levels. So if you look, our view on policy rates from the major central banks is that the US federal funds target range will still stand at 0 to 0.25% at the end of 2021. The Eurozone's key deposit rate, standing at minus 60 basis points, is actually currently stands at minus 50 basis points, but we suspect you'll get another 10 basis point cut in the second quarter. And bank rate here in the UK, also standing at 10 basis points at the end of 2021. But beyond that, we suspect that economic growth should return to around trend levels, and that policymakers would be sufficiently comfortable to start begin raising rates 2021 onwards. So that's a brief summary of our global thoughts, which we published yesterday. I'm open to questions that you may have.
Thanks a lot, Ryan. That was a great insight into our thinking. I'll just start with the first question, given that we had the first round of Ryan, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you, yes.
Yeah, perfect. So, given that we also had our first round of the announcement by the finance minister today of roughly 1 lakh, we estimate the actual change in spending by the government is actually 1 lakh crore versus 1.7 lakh crore headline, which is roughly equal to 0.5% of GDP. So just to actually sort of dimension that versus what other governments are doing, what percentage of the stimulus is actually funded? Let's leave aside the corporate guarantees for some time, but what is the percentage of fiscal deficit, funded fiscal deficit, that the governments are providing as stimulus? If you can just give a few numbers around US or UK, that would be helpful.
Yeah, sure. If you look at kind of, you mean in terms of the actual, I suppose, stimulatory measures or fiscal measures rather than just the loan guarantees.
That's right.
Obviously, as we know, kind of loan guarantees are very much are a contingent liability. Obviously, that there's no impact unless you have to implement those guarantees. In very broad terms, if you look at the UK's measures, I'll start with the UK first, obviously. If you look at the initial set of measures, the UK's gone through what has been two rounds of announcements already. Now, if you add up those, these are numbers excluding loan guarantees, you're probably looking at something like around 3% of GDP. Now, to caveat this is that we don't know the cost of some of those measures as yet. For example, the job retention scheme that I mentioned earlier, we won't know how much that costs until we know how many people are using that facilities. But as a broad estimate, we would suggest that actual fiscal measures, excluding loan guarantees, is probably something akin to around 5% of GDP. In the US, of that $2.2 trillion package that has been mentioned, I would just mention actually, if $2 trillion is the number that is widely quoted in the press. I think there's, for one, we still don't know the exact firm detail of every single policy measure as yet, but the Congressional Budget Office, which is obviously the US's main budgetary, I suppose, institution, they're quoting the number $2.2 trillion. And if you look at that, that represents around 10% of GDP. Of that, there are $504 billion worth of loan guarantees to large businesses and indeed regional governments as well, and another $377 billion for small business loan guarantees. So if you extract that number, you're probably looking at something around 5% of GDP in terms of US measures. In the Eurozone, it very much differs between countries. On average, among the major economies, you're looking at pure fiscal measures akin to something like 2% of GDP. But if you take Germany, where they're planning on approving a supplementary budget worth, I believe it's 156 billion euros, then that equates to around 4.5% of GDP. So you're kind of looking at numbers around that ballpark. There is, I suppose, one additional, as I mentioned, the Eurozone, I think there's probably just one additional point, which I didn't mention earlier, on, I suppose, the stimulatory response. Eurozone finance ministers earlier this week held a teleconference on activating the Eurozone's bailout fund, the European Stability Mechanisms, or widely known as ESM. They proposed that countries could draw precautionary credit lines from that facility, roughly equating to 2% of those individual countries' GDP, and that is potentially going to be signed off by Euro area leaders at a teleconference later on today. I think what we've seen from the Eurozone so far is a somewhat disjointed fiscal policy response, at least, and the key reason behind that is that the Eurozone isn't a fiscal union. But the triggering of the ESM would arguably point to a more Eurozone coordinated policy response. And one further technical point on that, if a country was to undertake a precautionary credit line from the ESM, technically it would also potentially open the door to the ECB's OMT program, its outright monetary transactions. You may remember that was announced back in the depths of the euro crisis in 2012 when Mario Draghi pledged to do whatever it takes to support the eurozone. OMT effectively allows the ECB to undertake unlimited purchases of government bonds in order to stabilize the eurozone. So that's just something to be aware of as well. Not to say that it's immediately on the horizon, but it does open up an additional policy tool.
Got it. Thanks, Ryan. You know, the second question I'll just move to very quickly is being equity players and looking at equity valuations and, especially how the long-term global environment looks like. There's a lot of questions and, a lot of thought around what long-term U.S. and global inflation will look like. Immediately, I think we should see some downgrades to estimates there. But what are we looking at long-term so that we can also anchor long-term yield expectations on fixed income globally?
You broke up a little bit there, but effectively you're asking about long-term inflation prospects.
That's right.
Is that right?
Are we sort of at the risk of getting into low inflation or a risk of getting a near-term deflationary shock as well?
To our minds, no, I don't think we are. As I said at kind of the start, on the proviso that the COVID-19 shock is short-natured and that it doesn't morph into something which becomes, it moves away from being a health crisis to something which is maybe becomes more of a credit shock, then we suspect that the backdrop to growth and inflation, the shock should effectively be relatively short-lived, i.e. if you look at kind of, I suppose, the quarterly profile of our growth numbers, what we see is a sharp rebound in growth. Obviously, during this period, the output gaps are going to widen. And that's going to put downward pressure on inflation, as will the commodity price falls that we've seen in oil. But the oil price shock should be time limited, given that inflation, by its very nature, is a 12-month-on-12-month, a year-on-year comparison. So unless prices continue to fall by a similar extent, that factor should fall out of the equation. But on the expectation that growth returns to come some kind of trend level by, in terms of growth rates, by kind of 2020, the end of 2021, going into 2022, output gaps begin to close again, and we wouldn't foresee a long-term downward shift in the inflation backdrop. I think the big question over inflation, and the one that has dogged major economies over recent years, is the seemingly the relationship between unemployment and wage growth has lessened, i.e. if you look at any level of unemployment, wage growth theoretically should be higher than what it has been seen. Now, what's been behind that? I think there's a whole host of reasons, but I think if you look at it, I think probably there's more hidden unemployment than the numbers would suggest, and potentially compositional effects. But as I said, if you have a view on economic growth, which returns to kind of trend levels in a medium-term horizon, i.e. I'm talking out to the end of 2021, growth returns, employment follows that, and unemployment reverts back to kind of, or rather it retraces the rise which we're likely to see in the coming months, then I don't necessarily see a reason for inflation prospects in the long term to be materially lower, i.e. I suppose what I'm saying here is we don't think this shock from COVID-19 is going to lead to a downgrade in long-term trend growth.
Thanks, Ryan. And I'll move now to a related area. And I guess I can guess your answer based on how you've answered this question, but let's just lay it on the table because, you know, it's again important for asset prices globally. What do you think of 10-year U.S. Yield, government bond yield long-term, risk-free rate as we call it? It was 2.5-3% before the crisis hit. It's fallen to less than 1% now. In order for investors to get a good handle on how to sort of price the cost of equity, it's an important determinant, as you know. How should we think about it 3 years hence?
If you're looking at long-term yields looking forward, as you said, I think you can imagine what I'm going to say, but I think on the view that, let's say this is a short-term shock and that there isn't a structural change in economic growth prospects and you return to a trend level of growth in the medium term, then our view would be on a fundamental basis that, look, if you're looking at growth in individual economies around trend, you're looking at growth, global growth returning to around 3.5% in the long term, that fundamentally that should support higher overnight, i.e. higher policy rates, and a reduction or rather a curtailment of asset purchases. And that should, to our mind, lead to a rise, albeit very gradual rise in long-term interest rates, i.e. 10-year benchmarks. Now, if you look at our forecasts, it's hardly a stellar increase in rates. But for example, end 2021, we're looking at 10-year treasury yields at 1.25%, 1% in the UK and 10 basis points for German bunds. So I suspect it's still likely, we're likely to remain in an environment of low or relatively low policy rates and indeed fixed income yields as well in terms of sovereign benchmarks. But we do suspect you should see a gradual rise over the medium term, particularly if COVID-19 proves to be a short shock to the economy and we recover thereafter.
Thanks, Ryan. There's, we'll move to the banking system next. I mean, if you've done any work there, it'll be great if you can give some insight. So for India, you know, we've just been through a substantial asset quality cleanup. So while we would not say we're definitely out of the woods because, really, what happens depends upon the length of the crisis, but one can definitely say that, you know, the banking system could not have a better position going into something like this. Also, you know, post the 2009 crisis, capitalization in general across the banking system has gone up. This I know to be true globally as well. How would you characterize the UK banking system, given that you're close to the story there? How would you characterize the UK banking system going into this crisis? Is there any risk a risk to the banking system per se?
No, I'm not a banking expert, but in terms of my broad views, no, I don't think so. I think if you look at where banks were ahead of the 08-09 financial crisis, you could argue that they were undercapitalized. Obviously, liquidity was a big risk. The situation now, I think, is vastly different. Banks are very well capitalized. All the major banks are very much well above kind of regulatory minimums in terms of capital requirements. You may or may not know that informing those regulatory minimums, UK banks have to undergo an annual stress test. Those stress tests, the stress test scenario for UK banks is equivalent, if anything, slightly worse than the global financial crisis, and all banks have passed those in recent years. As I said, that is passing a stress test, which is more extreme than 08-09. So from a capital perspective, they've all passed. Non-performing loan ratios in the UK are low. So from a banking perspective, I don't think there is any significant risk there. As you kind of said, banks are a lot more well capitalized than they were. I think one issue that has come out of recent weeks has been liquidity. And obviously central banks have tailored their response to address liquidity concerns. For example, in the US, there are significant, i.e. hundreds of billions worth of overnight repo operations conducted by the New York Fed. In the UK, the Bank of England announced a contingent term repo facility earlier this week. And the Bank of England also has other facilities as well, which allow banks to draw funds from the Bank of England, including the term funding scheme, which banks can draw down from later in April. So you've got those schemes there. So if you look back at 08-09, standing liquidity facilities weren't there in the same respect that they are now, and banks were less well capitalized. So if you look at where we are now, banks are more well capitalized. Central banks already have a toolkit which they can deploy, which allows banks to draw liquidity as needed. Similarly, if you look at the Eurozone, the ECB offers what they would call full allotment on their liquidity schemes, i.e. obviously subject to collateral requirements, banks can draw as much liquidity as they want from the ECB. So I think that these days, which weren't there in 08-09 and offers measures to try and mitigate some of the stress on banks, and certainly the central banks are very much aware that they do not want this crisis morphing into something which begins to hit the banks, start to hit credit market, hit credit conditions in terms of lending to households and corporates. And I think if you look at the composition of measures, that is very much what they've been aimed at.
Got it. Ryan, let's just shift back to, you know, the fiscal deficit and how governments in UK and Europe are financing them. So it's substantially being financed by the reserve banks of different regions. We potentially are also looking at that because we could probably, I mean, we estimate that fiscal deficit could go from a 3.5% that the government estimated to as much as 5.5%. And this is just based on what stimulus they've announced today. If we have to do more, it could go up even more. We're talking at least roughly 4 lakh crore of additional funding that needs to come from somewhere. The street is thinking part of it gets financed by the Reserve Bank of India. How should we think about, you know, because, you know, US, UK has been doing it for a while, and it seems to be expanding. How should we think about the risk of a government, of a bank starting to do that?
You kind of the risk around long-term fiscal stability concerns, I assume you mean.
Yeah.
I think, look at it, if you take where we are now, I think governments are around the world putting first and foremost addressing this crisis top of the agenda. Long-term fiscal prudence, you could perhaps say, has kind of got out of the window for now. For example, in the UK, when we had the budget in early March on the 11th, the fiscal deficit was expected to stand at 2.2% of GDP in 2024-25. That is from an estimate of 2.1% for the fiscal year 2019-20. Obviously, that doesn't take into account any of the additional measures which have been put in place to address the COVID-19 crisis. They are also predicated on GDP forecasts, which certainly did not take into account the potential economic shock what we're looking at in the first half of this year. So if you look at kind of long-term fiscal trends, I think clearly the direction is going to be a rise in the deficit. Similarly with the US, if you look at the US numbers, now the CBO had forecast the deficit in the US to be 4.6% for this year, and that rising to 5.4% in 2030. Now, that is before any of the fiscal measures were announced, and that is based on trend growth levels around 2%. Now, longer term, as I said, we don't think that there's going to be a change in that, but certainly near term, there is going to be a hit to 2020 numbers. So equally there in the US, those fiscal numbers are going to look a lot higher. Do we think that that's going to lead to significant... Now, I suppose before I go on to that, I suppose the question is what those numbers are going to go to. Now, I think at this point in time, it's far too early to say. Certainly, there's some numbers that we just don't know what they're going to be yet, i.e., for example, the UK, the jobs retention scheme. We don't know if the loan guarantee schemes are actually going to have to be used. So we don't know what impact they are going to have. So it's incredibly difficult to try and say or estimate what a fiscal deficit is going to be in 5 years' time or so. But it is going to rise. It's going to have to be funded through additional debt issuance. Does it... mean that fears over fiscal sustainability in the major economies are going to grow? I personally wouldn't think they will. I think markets would look at this and say that this is a one-off policy move to address an existential crisis from a virus that we know little about, and therefore fiscal response is necessary. Otherwise, the downturn in the economic backdrop could be far more worse, which would in turn mean that the fiscal numbers looking forward would also be worse. So from our point, I suppose from my point of view, I think they would look through the numbers as being a one-off response to a crisis rather than a long-term downward performance in the fiscal numbers, i.e. I think if you look at fiscal numbers amongst the major economies, certainly the Western ones, what is the bulk of it of fiscal spending going forward and how that's projected to rise? It's around social care and an aging population. So I think that longer term, that is a more pressing issue on the fiscal front rather than purely addressing, as I say, a one-off shock from COVID-19.
Thanks, Ryan. You know, we can actually open it up for our guests now. Moderator, can you open up the call to questions? Hello, moderator.
Thank you very much. We will now begin with the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and one on the touchtone telephone. If you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, you may press star and two. Participants are requested to use handsets while asking a question. Ladies and gentlemen, we will wait for a moment while the question queue assembles. Anyone who wishes to ask a question, please press star and one at this time. We would like to remind participants that you may press star one to ask a question. The first question is from the line of Saurav Jain from Coromandel International. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Saurav Jain. We work in agriculture sector, and we would like to know that how, if this continues for, let's say, one and a half months more in India, is going to impact the agriculture sector demand, both for input and output side.
Hi.
Sorry, I couldn't quite hear you. Could you just report? Repeat, sorry.
How this is going to impact the agricultural sector or rural economy in the country?
So, Ryan, I can try addressing Saurabh's question. Saurabh.
If you could, I didn't look at that.
Yeah, sure. So, Saurabh, you know, it's a tough question in a way because there is the near-term disruption from the supply chain, and the second aspect is there any genuine disruption on demand? So the supply chain disruptions, we've already heard that quite a few factories that may be using the agricultural inputs like Dabur, they are closing down some plants. We've heard as much as, you know, at least near-term drop in demand of 40% from these food processors, as you may call them. So yes, definitely near-term, there will be demand destruction. Having said that, you know, the broader economy, and we don't have estimates as to what goes into the broader economy, as in consumption by end users versus food processors. The consumption by end users, I think, honestly, should be less impacted because you know, the supply chain, is the PDS is working, the supply chain per se is working. So that part should not be impacted. So while there should be an impact on at least the industrial part of the food demand, I honestly think this is one part of the economy that should be impacted less than others. While it'll be tough to give a number, but I would just say that it'll be less than others. In terms of, you know, we don't have an economist on board, but the general sense is the GDP growth itself, if we were talking about 6.5-7% FY21 growth going into the year, potentially after this lockdown, you may see that getting cut by roughly 4% across the board by people. This is a very fluid situation, so I don't think anybody has a clear answer. But there will be a reasonable cut to, you know, overall GDP growth in the economy. So you can imagine that there will be some downdraft on the agriculture sector as well. But I would imagine, given the inelastic nature of the demand for products, that the impact will be lower than other sectors.
Mr. Jain, your question is answered.
Thanks. Yes.
Thank you. We would like to remind participants that you may press star one to ask a question. Participants to ask a question, you may press star and one now. The next question is from the line of Kiran Shetty from Canara Robeco Mutual Fund. Please go ahead. Mr. Kiran Shetty, your line is unmuted. Please go ahead with your question.
Hello. Am I audible?
Yes.
Hello.
Sir.
Yeah. I had two questions. One is, in case of, we've seen cases in China and Hong Kong come down once they executed the lockdown, and now they're in the phase of getting back to normalcy. But we've seen that cases in Hong Kong, there's been a spike in cases in these regions, again, even after people coming out of the lockdowns, which is again raising questions as to how much time would the economic resurrection actually would take place. In terms of, there would be worries that there'll be more cases coming up even after, the most of the population of various economies are being put into lockdown. So do you think there'll be a lot more time that they would take to come out? And secondly, in terms of the economic impact of the cohesive, easy money policy that is being executed. So we've seen trillions of dollars of economy of stimulus actually being done somewhere in during the global financial crisis, that is 2008-2009, and we were yet expecting when would inflation come in, as in so much money being pumped into the system. Now we're seeing again another round of never before seen amounts of economic stimulus being pumped in. How do you see that, the exit of that money coming out of the system in the forthcoming years? How do you see that having an impact, or how do you see that panning out in future? Thanks.
I got the first bit of your question. I struggled to hear the second part. You essentially asking about how the exiting from policy.
Yeah, the unwinding of the economic stimulus that is being done now. We've seen the stimulus being done even previously, and people have been waiting for inflation to come in. Now we're seeing a second round of stimulus happening. How do you see the economic unwinding of this would pan out?
Yeah, okay. I'll take your questions in order.
Sure.
In terms of the first question, I actually think that's a very good question, and that's very much a point of uncertainty. If you take China, for example, whilst China has reported new cases through every day this week, much of the, actually practically all of them have been imported cases. I think yesterday and the day before they had no domestically transmitted cases, as possibly the case on Monday as well. I think if you look at this, the question is how does this end? For example, if you take China as an example, China went into a lockdown, well, the Hubei province at least, at the end of January, and that is beginning to open up now. Wuhan relaxing its restrictions on the 8th of April, or rather it will be. I think so. You're talking about 2 months worth of quarantine, as it were, and I think if you take the likes of Italy, Italy, particularly northern regions, have been on some kind of restricted movement for around 3-4 weeks now. How long countries will have to maintain this kind of restriction of movement, I think, is a big question. We don't know. I think the risk is that if you take the likes of China, which have gone through the restrictions and are seemingly coming out the other end, the risk that they face is that you have imported cases coming from elsewhere, reinfecting the domestic population, which once again restarts domestic transmission and a reintroduction of containment measures. The answer to this, I have to say, is very much unclear. I think there is perhaps some hope among governments that they could at least find some kind of treatment that works or has some better impact over the coming months. Obviously, I think talk of a vaccine, most health experts would still say that is a good year or so away. So I think very much the risk is that there is certainly risk, and why we caveated, I suppose, our growth forecast in that whilst our central assumption is this is a short-term shock, it's very much going to be dependent on the evolution of the virus going forward. And whether or not you get reinfections beginning to sprout up among those countries which had seemingly dealt it. Singapore would be another example where they're being reinfected by individuals coming home from abroad. So I think that is a big risk, and one I have to say I don't know the answer to. It is one down to, I suppose, epidemiologists and the like and healthcare professionals and scientists over whether or not a medical response can be found to this in the coming months whilst countries try and restrict their internal domestic spread of the viruses through containment measures. But I don't think there's any guarantee that come 2 months' time in the UK, for example, when we decide to possibly relax our containment measures, that there's not a reinfection coming from elsewhere, particularly if you have other countries which aren't imposing the same restrictions and that they are letting the virus run more freely in their own countries, and then people from those countries coming, for example, to the UK. If you take the US example, Donald Trump suggesting he could relax their containment measures by Easter, which has been widely criticised by healthcare professionals, scientists and the like. And obviously a population of almost 300 million, if you relax those containment measures and you allow people to walk around freely with the virus, then you've got a huge reservoir potentially growing in the US of people with the virus who could transport that abroad. And as I say, I have to say, I don't know the answer to that. And that does pose certainly a risk to our forecast and anyone else's forecast that this actually is a more pronounced slowdown or shock. Right. For the moment, we're assuming that it is a short term. On your second question, in terms of unwinding stimulus, I think that's going to be a very difficult question mark for central banks globally, particularly given the extraordinary numbers being injected. In terms of inflationary outlook, what I would say is that, yes, post-crisis inflation has been a lot lower than previously. What I would argue, I suppose, to some degree, is that while some people have suggested the traditional relationship between unemployment and wage growth is kind of broken, if you actually chart the most recent numbers, I wouldn't say that the Phillips curve was dead, more than it shifted. And for any given level of unemployment, the level of wage growth is lower than it previously was. Now, under that premise, you would expect if economic growth returns and you have trend growth, unemployment continues downwards again towards kind of equilibrium levels or below, then the unemployment levels should remain low. And that should feed through into wage growth, although albeit it may be at a slower rate than it previously was, i.e. pre-crisis. But that doesn't necessarily mean that inflation goes away. It takes longer to pass through. And what we have seen to some extent in recent years, particularly in the Eurozone, is that profit margins have been squeezed rather than putting up prices. And that has been part of, I suppose, at least a competitional effect. But at some point you can't keep doing that and you're going to have to increase prices. So as I say, long term, we suspect that you do get to a period where you do have trend growth, unemployment is roughly around equilibrium levels, and you do see rising wage growth, which fuels inflation. Although it may only be around the target levels in Western economies, it's not rampant, but it's also not kind of... what I would say is that based on this crisis, as I say, I would say a short-term impact rather than something which changes the long-term dynamics, i.e. we don't think you see a structural change.
Okay. Just to add... the unemployment rate, do you expect it to go up? Because the general understanding is that given the current crisis, you should see unemployment rates actually start going higher, significantly higher. In fact, in the U.S., I think it's expected to touch somewhere around 10 to 12%.
Yes, that is a... I don't think anyone knows what those numbers are going to be yet. Certainly, unemployment is going to spike in the near term. If you look at the policy measures that are being announced, I suppose if you take the UK as a precedent, the idea of the government's job retention scheme is to try and prevent companies laying off staff, i.e. literally firing them, making them redundant, and therefore counting towards the unemployment figures, is that, okay, you furlough them, i.e. they go on leave, unpaid leave, for however long it takes, i.e. try to prevent that spike in unemployment, and the government covers the wages in the near term. But certainly it's undeniable that unemployment will rise in this scenario. But you have to take into account, say, for example, if you were to look at, very simply, on, I suppose, a high street level, a coffee shop in the UK, small business, if no one's out spending, that's going to have to close, or it's likely to have to close. So you are going to have people that who are unemployed as a result, or maybe furloughed. But once economic activity returns, i.e. once containment measures are lifted and people are able to go out and spend again, and activity returns to some kind of normality, then you're going to have to rehire those people. And that, again, that's on the proviso that this is a short-term shock rather than something that is more pronounced. But if your economic activity rebounds, you're going to have to replace those workers which you laid off because you had short-term financing issues.
Right.
So your question is answered?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. We would like to remind participants that you may press star 1 to ask a question. Participants, to ask a question, you may please press star and 1 now. Anyone who wishes to ask a question, please press star and 1 at this time. As there are no further questions from the participants, I would now like to hand the conference over to Mr. Mukul Kocher for closing comments.
Thank you very much, Ryan. That was very insightful and thank you for your time. Thanks to everyone. Hopefully, we get through this in the past and we'll talk to you again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
On behalf of Investec Capital Services, that concludes this conference. Thank you for joining us, and you may now disconnect your lines.